The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. We record the program in advance, and we're actually recording this show today on May 4th. And if we went back a few years in time, back to 1970, on this date, things were boiling over on the campus of Kent State University. It was a tragedy about to happen, and Howard Means has just written about it. A book called 67 Shots, Kent State, and the End of American Innocence. He joins us today. Hello, Mr. Means.
Hello, Vic. How are you?
Well, it's kind of a sad subject, but I think it needs to be talked about. You go back and you reconstruct the events that led up to the tragic day in Kent State. Tell us about that. Tell us how it started. Things had gotten rather chaotic in Kent, Ohio.
Things had gotten chaotic nationally, of course. This was the end of the 60s, the anti-war movement. Kent, you know, they all flowed together at this one place in northeast Ohio in a way, all these sort of rivers of hate, the generational divide, the sort of national angst after the assassinations of the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. There was an address to the nation Richard Nixon had made on the night of Thursday, April 30th, announcing that instead of contracting the war and bringing home another 150,000 troops, they were going to expand the war instead over the border into Vietnam, into Cambodia. Now, in fact, the war was already being prosecuted over there, but for the anti-war movement seemed a dramatic setback and a breach of faith on Nixon's part. So Friday at Kent was, first of all, it was the first warm day of spring. It was a beautiful day. Everybody remembers the weekend. It was particularly beautiful. Kids were, you know, the sap was rising, hormones were high, and there was a lot of partying going on downtown, string of bars on Water Street in Kent. Things get out of hand, in part because of the war, in part because it's just high spirits and too much beer. Kids start acting poorly, and the problem is that the town had been expecting, as many towns its size, college towns its size in America, were expecting the worst. They were expecting the Students for a Democratic Society and the Weathermen to come into their town, outside agitators. And what was really student behavior seemed to the mayor and to others as if it were outside agitators. And so at 1:30 in the morning, the mayor, a guy named Leroy Satram, who seems to have been a really estimable man in all other regards, simply hit the panic button. He had walked down the street or driven down the street. He'd seen what he thought was $50,000 worth of damage from rioting kids. It turned out to be about $5,000 worth of damage. But at 1:30 in the morning, he calls the office of then Ohio Governor Jim Rhodes, and makes the first inquiry about the National Guard. And that sets in process a chain of events that are both seem inevitable in retrospect and also entirely preventable at almost every turn.
Howard Means joins us. His book is 67 Shots, Kent State, and the End of American Innocence. I'm sure we have many listeners out there who were not around during the late 1960s to experience the anti-war fervor that gripped this country. We had a very polarized country at that time. Richard Nixon had just been elected president in 1968. His vice president, Spiro T. Agnew, and Dick Nixon both had very critical things to say about college students, about hippies, about anti-war protesters. These were very highly charged times, and I think for people who didn't live during that period, it's hard to believe how powerful that anti-war sentiment was. And that's really a big part of this whole tragedy, isn't it?
It certainly is. And you know, it was a war of rhetoric, really. Spiro Agnew on the one side, as you mentioned, Jerry Rubin maybe on the other side, who was head of the Youth International Party, the Yippies. And Jerry Rubin, an example of this, had come to Kent just 2 weeks before the shootings in a speech that was in a talk that was sanctioned by the university administration. And he had said Jerry Rubin was all about street theater. And, you know, for him, he told the students that in the beginning of in order to bring on the revolution, you first, quote, have to kill your parents. Now, he means this metaphorically. But not all the students in Kent took it metaphorically, and in fact, and the townspeople of Kent didn't take it metaphorically at all. They weren't into irony or into metaphor. And so that's all of what's, you know, this sort of war of rhetoric just kept ratcheting up. And then on the other side, Spiro Agnew kept talking about nattering nabobs of negativism, and Richard Nixon was talking about, quote, bombs blowing up campuses. And so All that rhetoric on that weekend of May 4th, the first weekend of May, got tragically translated into action at Kent State.
And you also look at the National Guard and these soldiers that came in and the conditions that they were dealing with. Mm-hmm. And this was a recipe for disaster, wasn't it?
It was an absolute recipe for disaster. The Guardsmen, I thought the Guardsmen were going to, when I started this book, I expected them to play more the role of villain in it. And by the time I was through with the book, I felt really poorly for them. I felt sad for them. The Guardsmen themselves, their leadership, they were terribly led. Robert Canterbury, the Assistant Adjutant General, made all the wrong decisions in the field. But also, they were terribly equipped for the job they had to do. They were called upon to do crowd control with battle rifles and bayonets and with tear gas. Well, on Monday, the tear gas was ineffective because there was a 17-mile-an-hour wind. Basically, it just blew the tear gas onto a lot of onlookers and got them angry and engaged in the protest. But tear gas aside, doing crowd control with a battle rifle lethal to half a mile and with bayonets is simply—it's virtually insane. And these poor guys were sent out there, given orders to go out and disperse a crowd, and they had no tools to do it. They had poor training to do it. And frankly, the mission they were called upon to complete was serving political ends as much as it was serving civil ends.
And when things came to a bloody head on May 4th, 1970, many of these students who were massed there for this protest, which was a violation of the rules, were just assuming that these guardsmen didn't have live ammunition in their guns.
They were certainly doing that. And the administration, the president, Robert White, again, a man that everybody liked as far as I can tell, but not the man to lead the university in this moment, never asked the National Guard commanders, anybody at the National Guard, whether the rifles were loaded with live ammunition. Nobody in a top administrative role asked that question. The assumption was they weren't, and there was, you know, there's no reason to assume that to be the case. A lot of the students were, you know, country kids. They were hunters. They knew that, you know, you always assume a gun is loaded until you prove it's proven otherwise. But yes, the fact that they didn't expect the guns to be loaded, the fact that when the firing started, most of them at first thought it was a chain of firecrackers or it was blanks. They kind of instinctively dove to the ground, but it wasn't until the fusillade was over 13 seconds after it began that many of them realized that they were live. You know, this was live ammunition.
The book is 67 Shots, Kent State and the End of American Innocence. Howard Means wrote it, and he joins us on the program today. The book just came out as we mark the anniversary of the tragic events on the campus of Kent State University, which came to a head on May 4th, 1970, and it could have been worse, couldn't it?
It could have been far worse. After the shooting, this is a part of the story that doesn't get told very often. After the shooting, the guard regrouped at the original staging area, which was near the burned-out ruins of the ROTC building at the far end of what's known as the Commons, the sort of grassy center of the campus, where the gathering spot. A lot of students who had been on the Commons initially never went over the hill where the actual shooting took place. They just remained there, but they started filtering back to this sort of central gathering spot. People who knew what happened, word passed around, the anger grew immensely, and what was a crowd of the curious onlookers all of a sudden was a crowd that was, you know, was almost beside reason with anger and shock at what had happened. At the other end of the Commons, there were 100-odd guardsmen. There were 800 rounds left in their M1s. And they still, the commander, Robert Canterbury, was still determined to, again, disperse the crowd that he was facing once again from the same spot he'd faced it an hour before. He told the crowd to move. Instead, a lot of the 20 kids, for example, roughly 20, stripped to the waist, drew X's on their chests and on their foreheads, and were genuinely ready, I think, to charge the guard positions. Well, it would have been a disaster. It would have been, you know, even without the 800 rounds, these were guys at least knew how to use a bayonet. And the fact that they didn't is largely due to the courageous and heartfelt and almost heartbreaking actions of one man, Glenn Frank, who was a geology professor at the university, an ex-Marine, and is the one absolute genuine hero of May 4, 1970. He put himself between the students and the guards. He begged the students to disperse. He finally broke down and cried. And the students kept, you know, saying and telling me when I talked to them and in their oral histories that when he finally broke down and cried, and they could hear the cry and the tears in his voice, that's when they knew this was serious. Well, by that point, Glenn Frank not only had the guard massed behind them, but the guard had also sent a group around above the hill from where these students were gathered. So the students were surrounded, and Glenn Frank knew a fatal, you know, position when he saw one. What he didn't know when he was pleading with the students was that his own son, Alan Frank, then a freshman, was in the crowd. And though Alan had not been at all on the side of the protest when it began, when he saw the kids get shot, he became just like everybody else. You know, ready to charge the guard, so angry that they were immune to fear, et cetera. So he saved his own son's life, possibly, too, or quite likely, too. And I should add that Glenn Frank paid for it physically and psychologically. He never quite got over what he did, you know, the sort of psychological ramifications of what had happened if he failed.
The book is 67 Shots, Kent State and the End of American Innocence. When I was a freshman in high school, I was a member of a gun club, and one day our advisor said he was going to take us out for a special treat, and we went to the town dump with a weapon, a rifle that he called a 30-06, and we were shooting holes through the sides of metal dryers and washing machines, and it was the most destructive weapon I'd ever fired in my life. And I was astonished to discover, reading your book, that this is the kind of gun that they were shooting these kids with.
Battle rifle, the M1 Garand battle rifle, lethal to half a mile. And I don't want to shock anybody by saying this, but if you line three people up at 250 yards, the bullet will go through all three of them if it doesn't hit a major bone without any problem. It'll move an engine block slightly. Bill Schroeder, one of the kids who was killed, a guy standing next to him, saw him get hit, and he said, Bill Schroeder was an athlete. He was a basketball player, 190 pounds or 180, 190. It lifted him off the ground and threw him back. One guy took shelter behind a tree. He ducked down, and when he got back up again, the bullet had gone straight through the trunk of the tree and kept on going. You know, it wasn't a thick tree, but it was a tree. It was a genuine tree. Another guy was behind a metal sculpture, and the bullet went through the metal sculpture and almost hit him. So, I mean, it was an insane tool to have. But as a result, there were people who were hit, and Sandy Shure is the most tragic of all these. She was walking between classes when this happened. She was doing what students are supposed to be doing. She wasn't attending to the rally. And when the firing began, she was out, 100-odd yards away, and the bullet severed her jugular vein.
It's horrible. Let's talk about some of these other victims, the wounded and the dead from this shooting. You mentioned Sandy, who was walking to class.
Yeah.
There was a young man who was gesturing towards the National Guard. He died, too.
The guy who was gesturing toward the National Guard was Joe Lewis. And Joe Lewis, was shot twice.
He lived. Okay.
He almost did.
All right.
Joe Lewis, the guard are coming back up this hill. They get near the top at a concrete structure known on campus as the Pagoda. They turn, they kneel, they go in a skirmish line down on one knee, most of them, and start pointing their guns. And Joe Lewis said, at that point, I thought they were making a gesture. And he said, being young and foolish, I made a gesture of my own. He stood up, he flipped them the bird, gave them the finger, and at that moment he was shot in the abdomen and the leg. Of the 2,000 people who were there when the guards initially moved out, there were only 30 to 50, by almost every estimate, who were hardcore protesters. The rest were curious onlookers. They were, they were involved to various degrees. Jeff Miller was one of the 30 to 50 that were hardcore protesters. He was a small, shortish guy. He was darting all around, yelling things at the guard. He was shot through the mouth, and it's hard for me to believe that's accidental. The M1 is a very exacting weapon. It's a sniper rifle if you want to make it into one. From a quarter of a mile, as I remember, the bullet drops about 8 inches. So if you aim between the eyes, you hit somebody in the lower neck or the heart. So Jeff Miller was shot in the mouth. He died. He bled out on the pavement. Allison Krauss was also active in the protests. She's very striking looking. She was easy to pick out in the crowd. A tall, attractive, slender woman. She was killed. She was shot in the chest. And then Bill Schroeder was the third one. I mentioned him earlier. Bill Schroeder was a member of the ROTC. He was a member of the freshman basketball team. By every account I could find, he was simply curious about what's going on. You see a photo of him in the crowd. It's not a very clear photo, but he has his books cradled in his arm. He's obviously stopped in on his way from one class to the other. And he was shot and killed as a guy named Dick Breedemeyer, who was then Dean of Student Activities, told me. Two died for commitment, one died because he was curious, and one died because she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And of the wounded, I should say, two, nine wounded. Many of them were, almost everybody who was shot, I should add, was not charging the guard position. They were turned. They were moving away from it. They were shot in the side or the back. Dean Keller was the worst injured of all those. Dean has been paralyzed from the waist down ever since. He was a bullet lodged in his spine. There was a guy there. Who was at the hospital when they brought Dean in, or his mother, I'm sorry, was at the hospital when they brought Dean in. And she heard the doctor say, "This is, talking about the bullet lodged in his spine," and said, "This is the most senseless thing I've ever seen in my life." So there are 13 stories that are all of them horrible.
And this was a period of time that I remember very well when a popular slogan among some Americans was, "America, love it or leave it." Mm-hmm. And after this horror, after this tragedy, you write how many people responded by saying they deserve this.
Oh, it's horrible. Yeah. The story. I mean, they said it in many cases to their own children who were there at the protest. Brinsley Terrell, who's an art teacher still at the university, was a young art teacher then, told me a story. They closed the campus immediately afterwards. They kept it closed for 6 weeks. But he said kids kept coming back because they couldn't figure out what to do. And one kid came and sat down in his living room just because he had to talk to someone. He had been one of Brinsley's students, and he'd gone home, and his parents had locked the door when he got to, when he got home. The front door was locked, and they shouted through the mail slot at him that they never wanted to see him again. And it just breaks your heart to hear stories like that. And there are way too many of them. Jim Webb, the former Virginia senator, told that was at Quantico, Marine Base at Quantico, Virginia, when this happened. He remembered somebody writing on the board, on a chalkboard, National Guard 4, Kent State 0. I mean, just horrible, coarse things like that. One of the guardsmen who was there emailed me yesterday to tell me that he had gone 2 weeks later to Camp Perry, and an instructor there had praised them for their work on the shooting range. He said, if we'd had that practice before Kent State, we could have killed 40 of them instead of 4. And these stories are just, they're just all over the place, and they just reflect, the horrible divisiveness of the times and just how powerful emotions were.
The book is 67 Shots, Kent State, and the End of American Innocence. Howard Means wrote it. It just came out, and as we're recording this on May 4th, it is the 46th anniversary of the Kent State shootings, and you did a lot of interviews. You were able to talk to a lot of people who were there, and it was interesting to me as a longtime music fan that one of the people who was there that you interviewed was a guy who went on to fame in a band from Akron, a band called Devo.
Yeah. And they were all Kent State students. Jerry Casale, his brother, and Mark Mothersbaugh, and the fourth one's going to escape me at the moment. But yes, Devo, one of the great enduring indie label bands of the last 40 years. And I was helped immeasurably in this book, I should add, by the fact that the Kent State University library archives people have done a wonderful job of collecting oral histories over the course of the last 20 to 30 years, well, since 1990. They've been collecting these oral histories, over 130 now, still growing. And this, when I started in this book, I just found this treasure trove sitting there of memories. So I was able to tell the story through the eyes and ears, the eyes, I should say, and memories of people who had been there. And not just, 4 or 5 or 6 people, but I had 130 people. I had this sort of 360-degree view, guardsmen, teachers, townspeople, and, of course, lots and lots and lots of students. And then I could do my own interviewing to fill in the gaps. But I was they've done a magnificent job at the library, and the archives people deserve all credit.
In my mind, remembering this period, the violence that day at Kent State seemed to be the other end of an arc that began in August of 1968 in Chicago during the Democratic Convention with the violence there and the police beating protesters.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. There is this sort of web of connection between the two events. And in a way, Kent State was the exclamation point at the end of that time. And I say at some point that it's almost, when you look at Kent State from enough distance, it's almost as if it's the Titanic and an iceberg coming together. And the way you could look back at the 68 convention in Chicago and sort of see both the iceberg and the Titanic going out in different directions and coming back together at Kent State, it's a really interesting observation. I think you're on the money there.
The book is 67 Shots, Kent State and the End of American Innocence. Howard Means wrote it.
The students had one plan, and that was to provoke and disperse, provoke and disperse, provoke and disperse. Students are very good at that kind of thing, as we'll all remember from student protests. But they had, a year earlier, the Students for a Democratic Society chapter on campus probably could have taken over and managed this protest movement. They had bullhorns. They knew how to contact and mimeograph machines. They could produce flyers, etc. But they had been thrown. They had been thrown off the campus. Their charter had been revoked in spring of 1969. So their students had really no mechanism for controlling the emotions that they had let loose. So. And then the guard had absolutely no capacity for producing a plan B, because all they knew to do was disperse crowds. That's what they took as their as their mandate and really their mantra almost. Mm-hmm. And then the role of Jim Rhodes. I had not fully appreciated the role of Jim Rhodes in underwriting this tragedy. Jim Rhodes was, and you might remember this, I don't know, he was locked in a tight senatorial primary campaign with Robert Taft Jr. This was May of 1970. Rhodes could not succeed himself as governor. The election was to be held Tuesday, election was to be held Tuesday, May 5. On Friday, by most polling, Rhodes was 70,000 votes ahead. He lost the election by 5,000 votes. He used this to sort of inspire his law and order base, his sort of down-home Republican base, and it darn near worked. It darn near carried him to the senatorial, to the U.S. Senate, actually.
Hmm. Well, Howard, we really appreciate your time today.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I really enjoyed this very much.
The book is 67 Shots, Kent State, and the End of American Innocence. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.
Soldiers and Nixons.